Good day, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show. It's for Saturday, July 26, 2014. My name is Marcia Mary Baker. And our topic for today is this: BRICS to the World, the Nuclear Future is Now. By BRICS, I hope you know, I mean the association called Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa that formed some years ago and just met in mid-July in Fortaleza, Brazil. They also had individuals meet in Brasilia. They had pre-meetings, post-meetings with people throughout the Americas. But what has happened is the content and thrust of that, of those meetings constitutes a pivot for the world toward the advancement of mankind and a way out of the current dead monetarist world casino system we've had for decades, that now it's advocates for that kind of insane, monetarist, speculative, deadly system. Its advocates are the ones behind pushing confrontation that can get us into a hot war, thermonuclear war. Syria, in the Gaza City, but in Ukraine, in South China Sea. That's not our topic for today, but you understand the stakes are extremely high, and in a way, our guests are going to have a good news message if we can make it all happen. And they are, I'm glad to welcome with me live here in the studio, Ramtanu Maitra, who is our new Delhi desk, that is our India specialist. Welcome, Tanu.
Thank you, Marcia. I'm glad to be here.
And Tanu gets around. He's was in India in June. He was in Japan sometime in the last 6 months. And I said he's our New Delhi desk. In fact, he especially specializes in Asia from, and Eurasia, let's call it that, from the Atlantic to the Pacific. But I'm so glad we have on the Pacific coast from San Francisco, we welcome Michael Steger. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Marcia. How are you?
Good connection. And I think the last time Michael was with us was just before that primary in the Democratic Party in California in early June, where Michael was leading a very important campaign, co-campaign with Keisha Rogers from Texas for an alliance for the necessary policies to deal with this world-class catastrophe of lack of water in the West. And Mike ran a fierce campaign. That's Nancy Pelosi's seat. Now, there's a lot of updates. Mike, in fact, Keisha Rogers is in Washington, I believe, right?
Yes, she is. That's
and
true.
You may know more and so forth to report from that. But so we'll get to this. I'll just say a couple of updates for our listeners today. And first, I'll say, due to people's busy schedules, this discussion today was pre-taped July 24. But in fact, you see from the topic, it's still more than timely what we have to talk about. And in a way, you could say that the meeting of this, the annual conference of Brazil, Russia, Indochina, South Africa, and other heads of Central America, South American nations who got together, has put the American system back on the agenda of the American hemisphere. And this is very exciting. And we, in particular, one of the reasons we wanted Tanu to be able to be with us today is, besides his knowledge of the participation of India and the newly elected Prime Minister, Mr. Modi, but Tanu's had a lifelong career in nuclear energy. And the content of the meetings in Brazil and other developments around the world show a whole new commitment to nuclear power. And in the EIR of July 25 cover date of Executive Intelligence Review, you can read Tanu's World Report, which you won't have any trouble finding it, but it's called Expand Nuclear Power for the World's Survival. This isn't a question of choice. This is a necessity. And the other situation that I'll just raise, and we might get into it more or not in the course of it, is on the enemy kicking and screaming against the positive developments for mankind, it happens to be Argentina in South America that's become the torchbearer for the right of nations to determine their future, to determine what their credit system is, to determine their commitment to science and growth, and not be so-called just victims of what's euphemistically called the markets, which is just a name for such situations that Wall Street or the City of London perpetrate, where, in particular, I'll just say briefly about Argentina. At a certain point in the decade of the 2004-2005, due to certain debt obligations that have been foisted on Argentina, it's like foisted on our city of Detroit or the state of California or other nations around the world, the nation of Argentina said we're going to restructure that debt, commit to pay a certain amount of it over time to other holders of that debt who are located outside our nation, and we're going to commit to growth policies in our nation so our nation's people will be benefited, and we'll also pay what some part of the worthy debt is, whether it's a lot worthy or a little worthy. Here's what we're going to do. A certain number of holdouts who said, no, we want your blood money, we want paid even over your dead bodies, didn't participate in the restructuring, had their obligations, their claims, bought out. They sold them to some what's best called vulture funds, financial scavenger, carrion crow kind of entities. The famous name among them is Paul Singer. He's a big funder in the Republican and Democrat, too, parties. And some of these funds, they have different names. I think NML Capital, Elliott Capital, and so forth. They now, in recent months and years, said, no, and I'll pay us in full. In other words, we want over 1,500% profit. We bought up obligations you were supposed to pay for pennies on the dollar. Now pay. And totally wrongfully, this has been upheld nominally by the federal court system of the United States. So Argentina is holding out that this is wrong. You cannot bankrupt. We will not accept it. And screw you, in other words. And this is not an isolated instance. You have variations on this theme. The way people in Detroit are being told, your city's going to be shut down. Thousands of your people won't even have water if they can't pay. Too bad, so sad. But debt obligations, and including unworthy, rotten, evil debt, has to be paid. Puerto Rico, the same. Again, that's not our subject today, but Argentina is holding up to that, saying, no, there is the principle of the sovereignty of nations and the welfare and benefit to populations. So we have a fighting situation in the world. That is the, I'm going to call it positive news. The dead system is still kicking, but we have the initiatives that can make all the difference. And Mike and Tanu, I'm going to ask you to indulge one more second. I just want to say, I don't know what will be happening on July 25 in Congress in the House of Representatives, but we here in the United States are looking to every hour of every day while Congress is in session to get them to do what's the critical thing, initiate impeachment against President Barack Obama for many, many crimes, but to break this paradigm of complying with the dead monetarist system so we can bring the world back from the brink of war, from economic destruction, and get on board this train that now announced it's running by the BRICS conference towards development as the name for peace. And I mentioned July 26 because July 25th in the House of Representatives, because it has been announced that that debate will take place that day on the fact that no U.S. troops should be committed for combat in Iraq. There's a resolution number 105. It's House Concurrent Resolution 105. It has sponsorship, including the Republican Walter Jones of North Carolina, including Barbara Lee, is she from California, Mike, the Democrat?
Yeah, she's from Oakland.
From your area, Jim McGovern from Massachusetts, and it has other people, Mr. Holt, I think he's New Jersey, and so forth. So there is motion. We as citizens are not waiting for motion. We need to lead it, but it's all happening. And so it's from that kind of perspective. That what Mike, what I'd like to ask you to do on the policy committee, LaRouche Political Action Committee TV, which is weekly and you're always on, and it was July 21st. You referred, I think, to the BRICS events and related as a victory for mankind. Could you start our discussion from that viewpoint?
Yeah, sure. Just to put it in context, yeah, I think a lot of these developments really started at the end of Bill Clinton's presidency, because you had kind of a coincidence of events, a conjunction of events at that time, which started a different process into motion and really kind of created what we now see today. And the biggest intervention was really the fact that though the political opposition to Mr. LaRouche and his associates had attempted to eliminate Mr. LaRouche's influence, both in the United States and globally, under George Bush Sr.'s presidency, especially around the time of the fall of the wall, by the late 1990s, Mr. LaRouche had become, again, really the preeminent figure in the United States regarding, one, the breakdown and collapse, inevitable collapse of the Western financial system. And that was beginning to organize leadership internationally, along with his wife, Helga LaRouche, who was very prominent in organizing in China and throughout Europe and Eurasia. But they had basically taken on the responsibility to organize what would be a replacement to now what had become, some by the 1990s, had really become kind of the hegemonic world system, this kind of the IMF, free market, globalization, floating exchange rates, kind of debt, criminal system. It's a criminal system, and I could say a lot worse about it. I'm sure Tanu could too, and maybe we will. But the fact is that they were creating a replacement. Now, specifically, what do I mean? In 1998, you had the Russian bond crisis. Mr. LaRouche was in discussion with leading economists, scientists, and political figures like Sergei Glazyev, today the advisor to Vladimir Putin, but even people that were more senior than at that time in the Russian networks, around what really the former Soviet Union bloc, Russia and some of their key allies like Belarus and Kazakhstan and others, could orient towards in terms of economic development. And that, traditionally, it's what's called an American system. You defend the nation, you have national sovereignty, you control banking, you get rid of these offshore Caribbean financial pirates, and you go toward the development of infrastructure and predominantly a question of development of energy towards most advanced energy forms, nuclear and nuclear fusion, fission and fusion. That had been a key factor in 1998, and it largely influenced Bill Clinton, who then called after the Russian bond crisis for a new financial architecture and challenged really the entire kind of oligarchy grouping in the United States and internationally. At the same time, you began to see the breakdown of the Western financial system. You had the blowout, really, of what was at that point the NASDAQ, this dot-com bubble, which really is just a fictional economic creation, the idea of the Internet becoming some form of, you know, cyber economy, really is a scam. It's a Potemkin village, in essence. It's just a bunch of front computer screens. You know, there's nothing behind it, really. And I can tell you firsthand from being in San Francisco, there's nothing behind those computer screens.
Yeah.
So the point is that what had happened was that nations like China and Russia had begun to orient towards the fact that there was a collapse of the Western financial system. The premise of their economic model was a failure. It was criminal. It was built on debt. It was built on fictitious value. Now, to what extent they grasped this was, you know, in various degrees, but what they began to do is respond to what Mr. and Mrs. LaRouche had called for. We're going to establish a new economic system. And these calls go back to the 1970s, 1974, International Development Bank, 1971, when Mr. LaRouche had forecast the breakdown of the Bretton Woods system. But what had happened by the 1990s is there was recognition of key countries, large nations, Russia, China. Now, Shatanu can give a sense of, you know, India's response in this, which eventually became known as the BRICS, which included Brazil, which became a major emerging nation, very large economy, the most dominant in South America, along with Russia, India, and China. And then by 2010, South Africa joined this orientation. And what has progressed since really that late 90s, early 2000 period? Well, the United States has been involved in the attacks on Iraq and Afghanistan, these perpetual war doctrines, the Bush-Cheney regime, the bailouts, the insanity of the Obama administration, which is really just straight Bush-Cheney doctrine. What these nations have been developing and consolidating, and now you see what you see developing amongst these countries, which was consolidated in Brazil, is not only a recognition of the defense of national sovereignty, the development of nuclear technology, of infrastructure, of space collaboration, but you also recognize among these presidents and among their political class, you see this in Argentina as well, given what Cristina Kirchner is now, you know, in her opposition to the Vulture Funds. What you see from these leadership, these members and their groupings around them, is a sense of responsibility for humanity as a species and for the recognition that there is an opportunity within human society, within the individual, to act and change the course of history. They're not becoming the victims of the collapse of the system. They're not submitting to the brute intimidations of an empire. They're standing up against it, and they're finding collective identity, a solidarity amongst various nations with various interests and, you know, in some cases, you know, certain oppositions and disagreements that they have, but a shared solidarity, really, which is now representing. In some cases, what you saw, you know, unanimous support from the G77 and other large nation blocs, which includes most of Africa, most of Asia, most of South America, 80% of the world really siding with this orientation. And these nations alone, the BRICS, represent nearly half the world's population by themselves. And so you see a kind of a shift not only in an economic policy, which really comes from the United States. This is the American system. What Mr. LaRouche offered them over the course of the 80s and 90s was a traditional American policy of development that we've been deprived of. That they've taken from us. They brainwashed us into this Adam Smith liberal model. So what I think happened in Brazil, in Fortaleza, and then in Brasilia with the unilateral discussions, the BRIC summit, the announcement of a new development bank that all nations can participate in, was a commitment to break from this empire and to commit to the idea that human beings intrinsically have the opportunity to shape the course of history from the future, not from the past. That we're not dependent upon past mistakes or past disagreements. We're fundamentally dependent upon our shared conception of the future. And that really does change the entire political strategic map. They've consolidated it. They've made formal agreements. They've brought in other nations. They've defended Argentina's right to sovereignty. This is a major blow to this empire. And if we get Obama out, and these next week and a half, this week in Congress, next week in Congress, are critical. Get Obama out, and the United States can join that process, and then we really do secure a very potential future for humanity. To the extent we don't get Obama out, and the extent we see an ongoing drive, as you described, for world war, then everything's at risk. Even though 80% of the world is preferring a new direction, a new system, the United States is a critical keystone in that process. And so that's part of the fight. And I guess we can start there and see where else we go.
Well, maybe we should get right into it, unless Tanu wants to add something here in particular at all on Mr. Modi or anything else. But such a key part of the commitments made in special treaties or agreements or memos of understanding between Brazil and Russia, Russia and Argentina, China and various countries, were to rev up nuclear power, Tanu. Do you want to go into that?
Yes. What I see with the BRICS is that the leading nations like Russia, China, and India, they all now pretty much accepted the fact that they will have to develop nuclear power in order to continue with growth, do its infrastructure development, and in the process do the agro-industrial development. And that is a good thing, that in the leadership of this new group, BRICS, three major nations are very much, I wouldn't say committed, but they're very much believers of nuclear power. And this is, the work is, in my book, you know, this is only the beginning, because we'll have to do enormous amount of work still left in order to make them believe, understand that the importance of nuclear power is just not a source of power. It is the most efficient form of power, and it also brings in many other things to the mankind, benefits to mankind like medicine, your food irradiation, all kinds of stuff.
Water.
Water, and you know, you name it. You know, every part of our society, every part of the, every ingredient that make our society grow, nuclear power has a contribution to make, and the contribution is made through very little use of fuel, and with the potential of inexhaustible fuel source, because you know, we can, of course, reprocess fuel, we can breed fuel, and that is all there in the nuclear system. There's no other fuel has that advantage. But at the same time, I mean, the many years have passed by with the world was sitting, it never sits still, it is sliding downwards. In 1995, I think, when Yevgeny Primakov talked about Russia, India, China, a triangular arrangement, and Mr. LaRouche also around the same time, started working along with the Russians and Indians, and to a certain extent with the Chinese, to develop this Russia, India, China, that these nations should take the responsibility for you know, taking care of the world and development of the Eurasian landmass, and considering the collapse of the American leadership here, and takeover by the City of London and Wall Street of all the basic policy-making instruments. It was evident to Mr. LaRouche and his associates that, you know, this thing is not going to go anywhere but downwards. However, the same kind of understanding didn't dawn upon these Russia, India, China group leaders at that point in time. I think there's my reading is that the leadership was definitely very weak. Russia was having Yeltsin at the time and was been completely devastated by the post-Cold War, or the collapse of the Cold War, and the looting that ensued after that. India was, you know, after Indira Gandhi and even after Rao, and India didn't have a leadership at that point in time to chart the path in the right direction, and forcefully so. In China, the things were starting to develop and grow, I cannot be too confident about that. I shouldn't say too confidently about that. But Chinese leadership was at that point in time was more keen to make sure that the Chinese Communist Party, CPC, stay in power. And in order to stay in power, they will have to develop and grow. And that was their focus. The world was not their focus at that point in time. And the easiest way to grow, of course, is, you know, mine coal, import coal, and develop power, burning coal, and all that kind of thing. And they did it very well in the sense that they grew very well, and they really mastered a whole bunch of technologies which prior to 1980s didn't exist in China. But also they made an enormous amount of mess on this by overuse of coal and the very many difficult things that you get into when you use coal as your power source. So nuclear was sort of kept, I wouldn't say at a distance, but it was kept as a one of the power generation source, which should be in the basket, along with solar, along with hydro, along with coal, along with oil, gas, and whatever you have. So there was really no real understanding that in the long run, and every country has a long run, and we as mortals will die, but generations will come and the country will have to continue. For the country's survival and country's growth and country's predominance in the world and the ability of the country to play a global role, you've got to have plentiful of power. And that plentiful of power cannot be generated through a burning of coal. I'm not preaching here the no limits to growth kind of thing. I mean, all these things are sources are a qualitatively much poorer than a nuclear power, which has the highest energy flux density. And it will be exceeded, the energy flux density will be exceeded only by fusion when it becomes commercial. But no other energy source can hold a candle next to nuclear power. Even when you are considering only the power aspect of it. But this thing was not understood. And I still have my serious doubts of how much is being understood as of now by these BRICS leaders, and that is a part of the education that we had always been in, and we have to continue giving them. That why is it that we are not nuclear freaks or anything like that, but here is the science, here is the technology, and here is the future. And if you abandon all that, you will eventually also end up in a medieval age. You know, there's no other way you can go which can ensure any prospect for your future generations.
Well, I know I should throw in here the TANU is part of a project on a forthcoming report that will be released on the common aims of mankind's benefits by going for advancement, nuclear and corridors of development. Full steam ahead. I don't want to use a retrograde energy source steam here, but it's not that you're a skeptic. You're just saying you want to go like hell. And from that point of view, again, the announcements made, it may appear to be few relative to what's needed or something, but they're critical in terms of for example, I'll take one example to make the point, and then either of you can. If you take South Africa, which is critical for the whole continent of Africa, and Tana, you yourself say something like over 400 million people have no electricity in the nation, in the continent of Africa. And over half of what electricity there is in the continent is in South Africa, and they need more. So as of the last couple of years, because of the world green, the kind of regime of the Anglo-Dutch Empire, neo-empire green policy of saying you can't have high technology, don't have advanced power, don't have South Africa, which has had a continuous nuclear research commitment and has the one nuclear power plant in Africa, they suspended any nuclear power development. Yeah. But just in recent months, they have reactivated. In the last few weeks, they're now committing to three sites, two nuclear power reactors each. That'll be six reactors. Now, this isn't to change overnight, but the same thing has happened. We can tick them off around the world. Hungary has made the commitment. Many Persian Gulf nations, good, bad, or ugly. Bolivia, as well as Argentina, Brazil, many other places. So, Tano, in your view, I know you're concerned that we make known what's involved in expanding this in terms of education, but also at the moment, the world can only build maybe 30 plants or fewer a year where you need 1,000 or more.
Right. And my assessment is that, the reality is that we can make about 30 reactors nowadays.
Internationally.
I'm considering only the pressurized water reactors, which are the reactor vessels that need an enormous amount of technology and engineering capability. We can make about 30 such reactors a year. Out of that, I think 12 comes out from Japan, who unfortunately, will not be consuming any in the short term, but I hope that they change their views over a period of time. 12 is available from Japan, and the rest of the 30 are mostly, well, there will be some in from France, three or four, probably France will not be using them. So you got 15 which will not be used, but the other 15 will be coming out from China, Russia, and they will be, you know, they will be consumed their own. And even the fact of the matter is that they will be consuming much less than what they should consume. So in other words, that and in fact, they will be, they're lining up already, the Chinese and even the Indians are lining up for the Japanese reactors. So what I'm trying to say is that for other countries who do not manufacture reactors, for them to get a reactor will be, they will get promises, they will get signed agreements and memorandum of understanding and all that kind of thing, but to get a reactor will be enormously difficult because, you know, only 30 reactors are manufactured nowadays. The minimum, my estimate is the minimum that should be, we should manufacture or develop the capability to manufacture is about 200 reactors. Until and unless we have 200 reactor manufacturing capability, we cannot say that the world is moving towards depending on nuclear power as its power source. Everything else, when if we continue to manufacture 30 or 40, you will be depending enormously on coal and gas and solar and wind and all that kind of stuff. Because, you know, you need power, you have to light up the houses. And, you know, with the 30 or 40 nuclear reactors that is manufactured worldwide, there is no way that any country can expect that their homes will be lit up with nuclear power. It's not possible. But
so you are saying this, it won't surprise any of us that we have a hell of a job ahead of us.
Yes, no question.
And so what we have is a call to action by the declaration from the BRICS meeting. It's the Fortaleza Declaration that called for a new development bank. It called, in other words, the commitment to the means to start, yes, to resume this track you're describing.
What I suggest to the BRICS leaders at this point in time is that, beside, you know, developing your, enhancing your capability multifold in manufacturing, reactor manufacturing capabilities multifold, you will also have to set up the basic technologies, manpower development, and basic infrastructure to manufacture nuclear reactors in other countries. I think that would be very important because what I saw now today and is that Vietnam is now developing, has decided to develop 3,000 nuclear-related technicians and engineers for their plan to have 6 reactors. Now, of course, the reactors they will import. I think Russia has committed 2. I don't know when they will be delivered, this is one aspect of manpower development. Is enormous amount of manpower we need in order to run those 200 reactors that I was referring to. And then the engineering capability. When you say nuclear reactor, you know, nuclear reactor comes in pairs. That means a nuclear reactor and the nuclear steam generating system. Together they call it the nuclear power plant set. So the entire thing, and now you cannot match a Russian steam generator system with a Japanese reactor, pressure vessel. So both have to come from the same place, and it is being mated together so that, you know, it is an enormous amount of engineering and very heavy engineering stuff. What I'm talking about, some, you know, the pressure vessels could be as much as 600 ton of steel. And they have to be put together, and with a precision that, you know, it's 7 to 8 inch thick steel, special steel, and throughout the pressure vessel, you cannot have more than a micron of thickness difference. So it is not an easy job to do. You need enormous amount of technology to develop these kind of things, and also a very strong heavy engineering background and an infrastructure, and also a power base. You know, you cannot develop this kind of thing using solar power. It's not possible. So you have to have a power base in order to develop the heavy engineering. So these countries have, if they want, and they should, to develop, see that the nuclear becomes the sole power generation source for the future in, say, any countries, whether it's South Africa, Brazil, Argentina, you name it, any country, Vietnam, Bangladesh, you name it, any country who has shown interest, Egypt, then Middle East, who have shown interest to develop nuclear power, you should go in, and South Korea could also play a very important role in this, go in and develop the entire infrastructure and the manpower. Now, all these things, you know, cannot be done overnight, and it will take almost a generation to develop the whole thing. 25 years, I give 25 years for a country to develop its engineering capabilities, manpower development, and the necessary power source to run all that kind of stuff. So if you don't start it today, by 2040, you will find that you are still in the same stage that you are in today. And it will be, only thing that will be worse is that most of the materials that you use for power generation, this coal and oil and gas, they're going away. There is nothing left. So you'll be all left with nothing at that point in time.
Well, this amounts to quite a call up for youth, as one another way to put it, that if you're talking about the next generation, you're saying this is a call up to a mobilization for the shift that Mike Steger just talked about, that for mankind on the planet. So that may be daunting, but you can't wish yourself into a different age and a different time. It's where we are now. And Mike, let me ask you, you may want to comment on many aspects of today's developments, but if we zoom in on your part of the world, you're in the Pacific Rim, where Russia, China, India, East Asia, and South Asia are mobilized. But then you are there in all the 22 states west of the Mississippi, where half of California's very small nuclear capability shut down permanently, I understand, and you're in the water crisis. So really what we're talking about is a very immediate situation for our nation from where you are, right?
Well, I think that's true. And I think if you take from what Anu has said, it's really not just the nation, but it is the world. And it's not just a power supply question. What we're referencing and what's at stake now is the food supply, is water supply. And some of these things have been taken for granted because in some cases they were provided through just natural, kind of the naturally given resources that our planet over the geological time period had fostered. So we had a certain amount of, you know, nutrient-rich soil. We had a certain amount of fresh water supply. But the reality of that is that the climate changes. Things are changing. And at this point right now, the West, a new report just came out from NASA this morning. It'll be published in a journal this week, which goes to how we have the Colorado River Basin groundwater supply has been depleted far beyond any expectations. And this is true throughout this whole area of California, but now this is the entire river basin, which the river itself provides water for about seven states and 40 million people. And this is going to have long-term implications because the flow of the river is going to be diminished regardless of what rainfall we get. The drought has not been 3 years. What NASA now identifies is the drought has been 14 years, which I think you've reported on before. This is a very extended drought. There are a history of mega droughts. And this is not just unique to the Western states, but it's a very immediate crisis here in the United States because this is going to have an impact. What they're describing right now in California is that there will be up to a maximum of about 18 months of water supply. Now, that's going to have an effect on many fronts. probably the most immediate that people are already seeing out here is the cost of food supply. Food prices are skyrocketing, especially the kind of summer fruits that you get that are usually at great discount because of their large supply are very much inflated because of a massive shortage. In some cases, like the cherry supply, is down 90%. So you have a real impact on food supply. The dairy cows are very dependent on water. A high productive dairy cow, if it goes without water for more than 3 hours, you're starting to risk the life of that cow. And so this is going to have, this has huge implications beyond what I think people really understand. And it's in the short term. I mean, in the next few months, within the course of the next 6 months to a year, you can see kind of a precipitous drop in food supply and a hyperbolic increase in food prices. Now, that's right now. That's in the next couple of months we can see something like that happen. And you put that in touch with everything else that we're describing, the political breakdown, the financial breakdown, the threats of war, and you see how this is a real physical crisis. Then the point is, how do you address something like this? And we've had proposals before from LaRouche PAC going back to the early 80s and in the recent period of a major water distribution program. Collect the water where it does exist in bounty and bring it to the places where it's, you know, in shortage. So in places like Alaska or the Yukon territories, there's abundant supplies of fresh water. The problem is the current drought is already moving up into the Northwest Territories, into western parts of British Columbia, through eastern Washington, up into British Columbia, and even into the Northwest Territories. This drought is severe. And so you can't assume that water will be where you want it to be. The critical factor in all of this, how do you address the ability to replenish your soils, to replenish your water supply, to provide the abundant electricity under these kinds of circumstances when you definitely don't want to depend upon wind or solar or any of these kinds of things? They're just, as Tom said in his article, these things just aren't reliant. You don't get full capacity out of these things. You maybe get 20% capacity over these much lower forms of technology. You've got to go where you can get consistent supply with the most advanced technology and the most advanced science possible, and that's nuclear. We go nuclear fission, we could desalinate. We could desalinate a lot of salt water. It could take 4 to 5 years. We could get things moving. But it's mostly a sense that you're going to start getting an upward motion towards the overall productivity of the country. And the other question is how we're going to start to harness water from the skies. And at that point, I think that what Tana raises in the beginning of his article and what he's discussed here today, what's the development of the younger members of society? What challenges are they presented with in school today? That's really where education starts. If they're asked, how do we make it rain? How do we harness? There's billions of gallons of water in our atmosphere every day. And in some places it rains, and in some places it doesn't. But what are the conditions for which we can make it rain in the places we need it to rain? Now, to develop that, you're going to need not just children who are pursuing that question, which is a very honest scientific question, but one very critical for mankind's long-term survival. You're going to need a skilled base of people in engineering, in manufacturing. We're going to need to move towards things like fusion energy to give us the scientific platform to address some of these problems, which are really beginning to act upon not just the surface of our planet, but really act within the broader scopes of our solar system, which is really the sun is probably the most dominant factor in our climate and atmosphere. So these are big questions, and you've got to develop an orientation towards it. This is really the only way we're going to solve these problems long term. And if we go nuclear today, as Thomas said, if you go nuclear right now, you have a shortage. Even if we wanted to build 4 or 5 nuclear power plants along the coastline of California,
you cannot.
We couldn't do it. And so you really see how the kinds of investments have to be made on a global basis. And the only way you can make these investments is you have to have the credit system. You have to go for a major kind of national banking public credit system, upwards of $1 trillion+ extended for this kind of development. And then you've got to find, and it's got to be a collaboration globally, because countries like South Korea, China, Japan, far advance the United States' ability to produce these kinds of nuclear components. So it's got to be an international collaboration. It hinges upon the United States' involvement with the public credit system. And if we do it and move on it now, then, you know, we can make things work. If we don't, you can see how it really is a perfect storm of an economic breakdown.
Yeah.
And, you know, history has seen this before. So.
And let me throw one thing in here in light of what you're saying. Is if you have the commitment, if we're mobilizing around the world, that's what's happening, the commitment to solve what otherwise appears insoluble and so forth. Resources are depleting. But certain principles are key, and that is the sovereign right of a nation, let me put it in an odd way, to even try. Now, something's happening regarding food, Mike, today. In Geneva, 160 nations are meeting that represent members of the World Trade Organization regarding the fact that India has stood up to them, and India doesn't want to go along with what the globalist monitors say, that there should, that no nation should have a right to stand in the way of globalized free trade, in particular regarding food, regarding having food security reserves, regarding its right to take care of its poor farmers or feed its poor low-income people. And India says, no, we have that right. Tana, do you want to give an update on that?
Well, this is the Bali agreement that, they, after Doha rounds, one after another, just collapsed. They came out with a Bali agreement in which there will be a trade facilitation agreement, which will basically agree to a free trade system.
It's called TFA. They make up initials because they don't want to say we're going to screw you.
The Indians, basically the Indian position was okay, we'll go along with it. But one thing that has to be put in there, because, it is not that the Indians came up with it, but it is the WTO has come up with it, is that that India has, I think, $12 billion of food stored for the poor people, which the government will have the right to give out at any price that they want, and even free. And this is an emergency storage for the poor. And WTO said that this is basically giving out is food in a subsidized form, and any country who violates the trade facilitation agreement, this is a violation of the trade facilitation agreement, and any country that violates the trade facilitation agreement, the agreement says that that country can be subjected to sanctions. So the Indians at that point in time said, well, you put it in writing that this subsidy for the poor will be acceptable. And
no sanctions if they do
no that. No sanctions or nothing of the sort. They said, well, we can do it for till 2017. By 2017, you have to come around and change things around. And then this clause will be valid only till 2017. India said, no, it has to be a permanent clause. And if we do not have it as a permanent clause, we are not going to vote for the TFA. And so far in our WTO rules say that everything has to go by consensus. Now we'll have to see. The July 31st is the deadline by which this TFA has to pass. And India is not going to vote, but whether they will stick to the consensus or they will go along with India violating it and India will be out of it, it is to be seen.
Yeah, and one thing here, it's not just a saga, another so-called narrative or anything like that. There's another, turn this and look at it the other way in reverse lighting. It means the zombie World Trade Organization is on the ropes. And this kind of deadline, like the deadline imposed against Argentina, that you have to pay blood money to us, and Argentina can say, no, we don't, screw you. Or India is calling the question for nations all around the world regarding food. Not just, and even for the United States, among our citizens. No, we have the right For example, Mike, what you're saying, if we're in a situation where we get Obama out, get moving, we can mention in the final minutes a few more updates in terms of the four LaRouche laws, we can call them, we're fighting for. They're putting price range controls so you don't have what you're describing as spikes of food prices, hyperinflation. We have a situation in the U.S. where it's highly desirable. We have food price controls, where we have parity pricing to farmers, and these kinds of measures can be done. So July 31st in Geneva is a deadline for the WTO to be rendered sidelined from all of history. And it may come to pass. I don't have a crystal ball on that. But that bears on what you're describing, Mike, about the kind of... you can't change things overnight, but if you're in the process of going in the right direction, then all of these principles come back into play.
Sure.
For every nation.
Sure.
Right. I'll just throw one thing in on food. I didn't mean the kinds of places. You described this whole Colorado River Basin. You're speaking from California, which is a fierce, parching drought. The place that has, in the high plains, that's above a multi-state Ogallala aquifer. That's a kind of underground formation that's been used through wells, and other than the northern part of it, not replenished. They have a situation, you know, I'm glad to say, there might be one of the biggest corn crops in the eastern part of the Midwest in history. Everything's been perfect so far. I hope it remains so. But do you know, while it costs a farmer $4.50 to produce an acre, thanks to the speculation in Chicago, corn is selling in some places for $2. So this is what we're on the brink of changing through the implication of what's happened with the BRICS and through forcing Obama out and getting in the moving on getting Glass-Steagall reinstated, getting a credit system, get nation-serving banks, and moving on these projects. And maybe, Mike, you, either one of you, but if you want to say more about this, and the we'll call again on people listening who are giving orders to their congressmen to keep at it, right, Mike?
Absolutely. And I think this question of directionality is so important. And that's, if you take the four cardinal laws that Mr. LaRouche has put forward, and they're cardinal because they really are what should be, you know, new amendments to the United States Constitution. Hmm. In essence, they're really the substance behind, you know, FDR's four freedoms. And if these four laws progress, as one is introduced, the other one becomes of a greater necessity. So the first one is the re-implementation of Glass-Steagall. So in the vacuum of Obama's removal, we immediately restore the Glass-Steagall legislation, shut down these speculators, shut down Judge Greisa, shut down Judge Antonin Scalia. This guy should be thrown out. He should be given a permanent leave of absence from the Supreme Court. This is criminal. These guys are thugs, Nazi-like jurists. Or not even Nazi-like, you can just call them Nazi jurists. So Glass-Steagall comes in, back as U.S. constitutional law, separates the speculative debt, and has these bastards eat their own, you know, defecations. That's for them to eat. It's theirs, and they can have it. They can do with it what they want to. The second thing, once we get Glass-Steagall and we secure the better assets of the country, you've got those are unsubstantial. We have not had the kind of growth, we have not developed the kind of assets in this country over the last 40 years that are sufficient to fund the growth we need. So intrinsically, we have to set up a national banking system and really multiply the assets of our country and the future wealth of our country through a public credit program. That public credit must invest into areas of productive employment. That means at one level, infrastructure, manufacturing base, the machine tool sector, the aerospace sector. You must get people re-employed. You must develop a kind of capital base of population involved in productive employment. At the same time, we must rebuild the infrastructure set so we're capable of handling the heavy industries that Tan is describing. I mean, this requires not just the facilities to produce, you know, 600-ton steel production, but also the ability to transport it, to develop the resources, and so on. So we need to develop that within the United States. With a public credit extension from a national banking system under the U.S. Treasury. Now, once we establish that, things are moving in the right direction. But to make it all work, because we really are 40 years behind in terms of our development, that we should have already accomplished a thermonuclear fusion foundation, both in prototype and in commercial reactor. That was to be online by year 2000, from 1980 congressional legislation. So the real key to this, because of what fusion represents, is it indicates really what it defines to be human. We have a voluntary ability to transform the way the universe itself is functioning. As Einstein might say, we have the ability to transform the space and time of our universe itself. This was defined very, very clearly in very precise empirical terms by Vladimir Vernadsky of Russia, a key scientist, a very strong proponent of nuclear technology, who understood that that really is the key to mankind's advancement. It's almost a natural, he might say, a natural impulse of the human species to look for more advanced ways of transforming the material supply of our universe. That we have a natural instinct, a higher impulse, you might say, or higher instinct to transform what we're given in more and more advanced ways. And fusion really is critical to redefining our species as truly human. And those become the four laws, and they really do proceed from one another. Because really, to have that kind of fusion driver, you'd have to have the kind of infrastructure, the kind of commitment to nuclear fission that Tanu has prescribed. So, and this is really the funny thing. What we're finding is that people are responding in the population, in Congress. This kind of outlook is critical if we want to move Obama out in the next 10 days
right,
or sooner.
So. Right, Mike. I just want to add one more thing. And since this discussion was about BRICS, the one other important thing that I'm looking at what BRICS has suggested is that BRICS has now put the drug traffic, eradication of drug, as in their agenda. Actually, the Russian anti-drug czar, Viktor Ivanov, had put this in the G8 agenda, which is G8 summit was supposed to be held in Sochi, but they kicked Russia out of G8, so it is basically eliminated from G8 agenda, which is, you know, fine for City of London and Wall Street. But this is what the drug eradication plan, if BRIC puts in, that will put in, that will create an enormous crisis for this casino type financial system that has been set up. And the enormous amount of money, this drug money that is being utilized other than playing lottery in the financial districts, is also for maintaining the terrorists all over the world. So, you know, if this thing is taken up by BRICS, the BRICS leadership, seriously, and they go after it with the kind of intensity that is necessary, then we are definitely looking for a future where such developmental things that we have proposed over the years can be undertaken.
Well, gentlemen, I think you've said it enough. Well, never enough, but for today, our time has run out. It is July, our LaRouche show for July 26, 2014. And I think while there is reason for grounds for great fear and trepidation at the world of these crazies on the loose, to be human is to be hopeful. And we have a lot of grounds to hope. And I thank you for developing all this, Mike Steger, Tanu Ramtanu Maitra, and so we'll close off July 26, 2014. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marcia.